We're going to make another leap now. We're going to talk about the Linda Wilson case and what led up to that. Now, Linda Wilson was just an ordinary lady, so it would appear, who had the misfortune of being implanted with a men breast implant. And she had a very bad experience with that breast implant, and she had a lot of surgery and pain and discomfort and inconvenience in her life. She contacted you, did she not?
Yes, she did.
So can you tell the audience a little bit about that case? Because I think it's very important.
That, too, is a kind of a long story, and it has many links into government and out of government. To put it succinctly, Mrs. Wilson, who was a very sophisticated lady and herself a business lady, she was an administrator for a specialty construction and engineering company in BC, that as a result of a mastectomy, she was implanted with two prostheses of the most controversial kind. She indeed wound up not just in simple difficulty, but in extreme difficulty, which ultimately cost her almost equivalent to 1 to 2 months of hospitalization, during which BC Health was forced to pay probably in excess of $300,000 of healthcare costs expressed in $2,000 Canadian dollars.
Yes, I wonder how often that's been repeated in the country.
Surprisingly often.
Yes, I can imagine.
We had at the time knowledge of a number of patients who had wound up under extreme difficulty and pronounced and lasting adverse effects. In fact, there was another one which also had surfaced about the same time, also in BC, which led to almost concurrent litigation. Her name was Hollis. I don't remember her given name, but that is what... It was exactly parallel. It occurred at about the same time.
So Linda Wilson, when she came out of hospital, she felt she had suffered grievous bodily harm. So she wanted to sue someone, didn't she? That she felt that someone was responsible for that, laid her case against who? Doctors or Health Canada?
Well, I can't address exactly her feeling, but in the final analysis, the case was levied against a group of surgeons who had participated in the implantation of the faulty implant, and that's where it ended. There were she, in her eyes and in the eyes of her solicitor, believed that the surgeons were collectively responsible for her misfortune and her misadventure.
Okay, so when did she contact you in all of this? Where did you...
I can't remember the dates exactly, and I have no records on hand, but the figure of about 1987, she was known to me in 1987 as a file. In 1988, it had blossomed into litigation in Vancouver.
I see. And so you actually, your contact with Linda Wilson then, did you sort of say, well, look, Mrs. Wilson, I think that the Health Protection Branch has some responsibility in this matter for allowing these breast implants to be on the market in the first place?
Well, that didn't really arise in the first place, I think, and it's not contact with her, but it's her solicitor, to my recollection, who contacted us first.
So her lawyers then, when they were building the case,
they
included you as part of their plaintiff's
defense.
Oh,
no, I became defense. More than that. I became a material witness because effectively, I was asked for an opinion as to whether or not the surgeons had acted appropriately by selecting these implants.
Now, something came... I was quite shocked, actually, and I hope we can share this with the listeners. At the time of the trial, you were under a gag order, weren't you?
Yes.
Who imposed that gag order?
It was part of normal department procedures, attempt to ensure lasting peace between individuals who leave the department and the department.
So at the trial, you weren't really able to discuss the Health Protection Branch then?
Correct.
Now, as I understand it, Linda Wilson lost her case, and I think it's sort of quite common knowledge that she feels that she was not treated as she should be treated. Now, there's quite a lot of now at that time, who was the health minister? Was it Monique Bégin?
No, Madame Bégin had left the department a long, long time ago.
Who was it then?
I believe she left about 1982, 84. In fact, she did not run for re-election when the first Mulroney government came in. The first minister of health following her was a gentleman from Winnipeg. I can't remember his name for a moment now.
Oh, Mr. Epp?
Yeah, Mr. Jake Epp, who was a very good minister,
mm-hmm.
But perhaps not entirely free to do as he wished.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think if
you hadn't have been under a gag order and you had been able to testify against procedures at the Health Protection Branch, do you think that Mrs. Wilson may have won her case?
I don't think so, because the way that the case was structured and the way the claims were put together, it placed the responsibility squarely on the surgeon, and it labeled the surgeon as the learned intermediary, and therefore the case was absolutely dependent on the demonstrating unethical behavior or medically unacceptable behavior on the part of these surgeons.
And they just pleaded that they were just learned intermediaries and were not really responsible for, you know, the product behaving in a bad way, right?
Well, they made the assertion that they knew that the product was on the market and therefore it would have had to be approved by the department. And that's exactly what the judge reiterated.
Yeah, so the ball was put squarely in the Court of Health Canada.
Correct.
Yeah.
And not only that, my recollection from the magistrate, and I forget his name.
Hood. It was
yeah,
Judge Hood.
Judge Hood, I forget his given name. But he said something in his written conclusions that even if the product was a total failure and was highly dangerous, and that the physicians had used it even though they knew it was dangerous, even under these circumstances, according to Judge Hood, he believed, or at least he wrote down, that Mrs. Wilson would have had the surgery anyway. I don't know what was the basis for his conclusion, but that's what he put down. Therefore, this perception alone.
Oh, so he blamed the victim then?
He blamed Mrs. Wilson essentially for having accepted the procedure.
Good Lord. Now, also, I understand that there was a certain amount of RCMP activity around this case, and some people might consider that their activity was not quite kosher. Now, do you want to expand on that? Can we tell the listeners what were the RCMP doing, being sort of influencing this case? What were they doing?
Well, that's a good question, but it's a story in its own as well. It has its own little branch, and there's enough to write a novel in it too.
Can you not? You must enlighten us about this.
Yeah. Thing. Now, to set story straight, the RCMP were not involved at the outset, and they were not involved until the case materialized. At least, not to my knowledge. They became involved later, when the case was not yet. The case had gone through its course, but there was yet no judgment. It took almost a year between the hearing of the case and the written conclusions being, the judgment being published, so to speak. So effectively, there seems to have been a lot of thinking going on. There was a delay of almost a full year between the hearing of the case in Vancouver and the rendering of the judgment by Magistrate Hood. Now, this is very rare. People don't hang around for a full year just waiting for the time of day. Obviously, there were behind-the-scene interventions and possibly a lot of things, but whatever it is, a year lapsed. During that year, I believe representatives of Mrs. Wilson wrote a request to the RCMP relating a lot of anomalies that had been uncovered during the case and asking that the RCMP investigate the Department of National Health and Welfare, or at least certain elements within it, to establish whether or not these were in accord with Canadian law.
Okay, go ahead.
Now, at the request was made of the head of the RCMP, who apparently waited a certain amount of time, I think something of the order of several months, and then wrote back an official letter to the effect that he thought that the department had done a very good job and that there was no basis to investigate anyone within the department, that everything was fine and they wanted to retain everything that way. At that point, the communication with Health and Welfare and the Department of Justice, which is the custodial department responsible for the RCMP, became very much envenomated. There was a lot of bad blood between the solicitors and other elements involved in the Wilson case and these agencies, and there were accusations of misplacement and inappropriate handling of files, leakage of information to defendants, and a lot of activity which is not deemed appropriate for government departments of any kind.
The Réal Leperrier, you mentioned that he sort of thought that, you know, women would have these breast implants anyway, regardless of the fact of what Health Canada would say or do. So that was very similar in a way to Judge Hood in the Wilson case, his deliberation in that.
Well, actually, it was not limited just to him. There was virtually
same philosophy, though. It's the same philosophy, isn't it?
Well, it's very similar language, but it's not limited to these two sources. The plastic surgeons and the Association of Plastic Surgeons all said the same thing in a chorus during, in fact, at many times. They did so in 79 and 81 and 83. In 84, they fought against the introduction of regulations for these products as well. And this recurred again in 88, and it recurred most intensely in 1993 when the U.S. moratorium was enacted. Moratorium being when the U.S. government said to the plastic surgeons that hereafter they would have to refrain from implanting those devices.
You see, that's quite extraordinary in a way, because I've looked at all the annual reports of the health minister to the lieutenant governor over the years from about 1970. And, I mean, the health protection branch takes hundreds and hundreds of products off the market every year because they...
That's not so. That's not true. It's a misconception. Hundreds and hundreds of products fall off from the market, most of them through economic considerations. Company go bankrupt, distributors drop the product. The department, to my knowledge, has never removed physically a product or a drug for many, many years. And the few occasions where it has, it usually had to reverse its decision under the ruling of one or more courts.
Okay, back to the RCMP and Norman Inkster. So Norman Inkster, Mrs. Wilson claimed that there was various impropriety going on at the Health Protection Branch vis-a-vis the safety of the breast implants. And
specifically, misconduct in the context of the Wilson trial, he explicitly said that it was absent.
Now, what was done at the health? Tell us what was, because I have actually a letter from the time from actually Michael Axworthy to Perrin Beattie that outlines some of the misdemeanors. Can you tell the audience what they were?
Well, the representatives of the Wilson Party wrote several letters to ministers and to opposition MPs. Remember, at the time, this was in the late years or of the last progressive conservative government, possibly the last one we'll ever have. At that time, the people who are now ministers of the current government, as we speak, were opposition members. Lloyd Axworthy, who is now, I believe, my recollection, I believe he is a member of a diplomatic delegation in Europe. At that time, he was an opposition critic for Health. He was briefed and received a complaint by, I believe, the solicitor to the Wilson case. As a result of the briefing, he wrote a letter to the then Minister of Health, who was, I believe, Perrin Beattie, who later became a chairman of the CBC under the Liberal government.
Yeah, well, tell us what the improprieties that were mentioned in that letter. He was accusing the health protection branch.
Illegal
acts, was he not?
Yes, he accused the health individuals within the health protection branch to be actively performing acts, procedures, and documentation aiming to cause the loss of the case on behalf of Mrs. Wilson. In other words, he accused the department of playing favoritism and of tilting the balance grossly in favor of the plastic surgeons. He accused the department of losing files and of leaking personal medical files on Mrs. Wilson, the plaintiff, to the defendants, which was a large Canadian insurance company responsible for defending surgeons from this type of malpractice case. He also accused them of deliberately misplacing and mishandling important documents and material, pathological material, for example. And he also accused them of essentially fibbing to courts over what was actually taking place in the department at the time.
Now, there was another thing came to my attention vis-a-vis Linda Wilson's case, too. Am I right? There is a press clipping from the time of the Wilson case that was a French newspaper that actually showed, told of Réal Leparrière's son being indicted for issuing telephone death threats to Mrs. Wilson. Is that correct?
It was much broader than that. I'm not close to this particular situation, but there were press clippings about another trial in Montreal this time, and it was by a group of support group leaders. These are individuals who had received breast implants at various times.
But Mrs. Wilson was one of them, wasn't she?
Yeah, but she was not a member of the group per se. This situation did not take place in the context of the Wilson case. But the individual in question, who was either a family member or an employee of the Leparrière Enterprises, was accused and brought to court to stand a trial over uttering threats and death threats to a group of individuals
who were
involved in a program to essentially motivate the government to withdraw the authority to sell breast implants, which would have affected the company, of course.
I see.
So basically, this was just an old-fashioned threat of the kind that we're now discussing in the context of the motorcycle gangs in Montreal. It had very much the same coloration.
Now, Pierre, we're going to stop the tape because we need to turn it over.
Okay.
Also, in my chats with you, a document on this too. You know, in the mid-1980s, I think quite a few MPs were being lobbied by breast implant survivors and things like that to bring up questions in the House about the safety of breast implants and was Health Canada right in allowing them to remain on the market, even though, you know, there was no safety data from the corporations. Apparently, these MPs were threatened, were they not, by the corporations?
Oh, some of
or
them
by
were.
A corporation?
So, some of them were, and it was quite general. And this happens all the time. It occurs for almost under. It's part of normal government operation, of government business. People get threatened all the time, and it's not a U.S. phenomenon. I think it happens just as often in Canada.
So these corporations sort of going around to the offices of these various parliamentarians with a carrot or the stick scenario and just leaning on them and saying, now, shut up. Is that right?
That's probably what it amounts to, but they also use carrots as well as sticks.
Right. But if you didn't conform, then you would get the stick in some
form. Something like that, yeah.
Yeah.
One MP in Ottawa physically ejected a complete delegation for improper behavior somewhere in 1990. And that's documented, I think, in another...
Mm-hmm. So let's put this in a context for the listeners. We've got multinational corporations interfering with our parliamentary process, our democracy, and our parliamentary system, and our MPs, in order that their products can stay on the market, even though they are not proven to be safe.
But we can't blame it entirely on the foreign corporations, because very often parts of the delegation included the Canadian representatives and their employees. They were some of our own people. In other words, the foreign corporations enlisted local help as well, and they were just as effective and just as pressure producing as their foreign counterpart. So it's a combined effort.
Mm-hmm. With all the various people who have an interest financially.
Correct.
Or otherwise.
This is what government nowadays refer to as stakeholders. I'm assuming they mean a pointed stick, and probably that's a good name for it.
I wonder if you can answer this in a direct manner. Do you think the RCMP were involved in illegal acts covering up things that were happening in the Health Protection Branch of Health Canada?
Well, there's no question that they were, and it's reflected in communications with their commissioner. But I have no idea as to who within the RCMP wrote the documents for Mr. Inkster and who performed the initial investigation. This was never
so you revealed. Have you seen these documents?
Oh, yes, these documents exist. So and the letter that circulated between Mr. Inkster and the attorneys for... the Wilson Party produced material in writing, and there's no question that the RCMP dissembled over what took place, because later on other documents produced by the RCMP made it very clear that they knew what was going on, and that it's not what they told in their reply letter. So there's definitely an anomaly there. How much interference the constabulary forces performed, that I don't know. That would be matter for another investigation.
Mm-hmm.
Regarding the ethics of self-investigation. Because basically, the RCMP investigation of the Department of National Health and Welfare, say in 1989 and 1990, would amount to asking a regulatory body to investigate itself and to tell the people if it did the right thing. It's an extension of the same agency, and anyone involved in the investigation would be subject to punishment if they came up with a conclusion that did not agree with the wish of the then involved ministers.
Now, I myself asked the commercial crime section of the RCMP to investigate the Health Protection Branch, and I did that much later than Mrs. Wilson. And they investigated for 2.5 years in my instance, then they came back and said that they hadn't found any criminal activity at all, and basically it was all dropped. Now, since you're telling me this about their interference in the Wilson case and in Health Protection Branch and so forth, and that there are documents that can prove that there was certain interference by the RCMP in sort of hushing up the breast implant scandal,
well,
and the tainted blood scandal, would you say then that they were in a conflict the second time around, that perhaps it was impossible for them to properly investigate because they were actually involved in the cover-up itself?
Well, the second time around, the constabulary were asked, in essence, without perhaps your knowing it, to investigate itself. Because on the first round, when Mr. Inkster was in was commissioner, clearly they had dissembled, they had fibbed. And therefore, a second investigation by employees of the successor to Mr. Inkster certainly would not have looked good if they had concluded and written a report to the effect that the RCMP had fibbed on a prior occasion. So it's a self gone conclusion. It's very much like the Afghanistan debacle over the accidental bombing, the friendly fire. It took outside agencies to uncover the fact that something went very wrong. It's certainly not the agency who was responsible for the fiasco who came up with the conclusion. And the same is true for government. Government does not investigate itself. It cannot, and it never will. And there's good reasons for this, and they have to do with human nature and the way government departments work.
Okay. We'll have to leave you now, Pierre, but thank you sincerely for being with us today. Now, Kathy, getting back to your website and everything, now you also feature the Gulf War disease, do you not?
Well, we have some links into Gulf War syndrome. We do network with some of the primary researchers that look into Gulf War syndrome. We have, of course, some other organizations that are even here in Missouri. One is Miss Riley, that is absolutely another registered nurse that I have, I take my hat off to her, that she was in Houston, Texas. She has moved her organization about 35 miles from where we're located in Missouri. And Gulf War syndrome it happens to be their expertise, but we're very much looking in our new website that will be appearing on September 1 when we do our new pages, that Gulf War syndrome, that we will be linking in to a lot of her items, a lot of the research done, because we're very concerned to see if it was caused by some of the vaccines or the chemicals that were used in the Gulf War. Absolutely.
Oh, of course, those servicemen were had multiple vaccinations in a very short time, and they were given a lot of adjuvants too, weren't they, with those vaccines?
Yeah. Absolutely, Elaine. And what we see with vaccines happen to be another that I would like to say specialty. We're just building on that now. We're learning a lot about vaccines, and we will also be linking into another area concerning vaccines, which is called thimerosal, which was the preservative that is used in a lot of the vaccines several years ago, and they believe there is a direct link between, which was thimerosal is mercury,
yeah.
And they believe that there is a direct link into mercury poisoning and, of course, autism.
And oh, yes. I have done some shows about that before,
yeah.
About that link. Yes. Now, going, I don't want to get too much off topic because we're running out of time for the show. I want to go into the big whammy that we've got up our sleeve today for our listeners. And, you know, there's the old saying, and I told you I was going to say this on the show, you know, don't ask for who the bell tolls, it tolls for thee. And this is something that you realize. You know, I once had a very dear friend from Chile, and he was he was imprisoned, you know, when Allende fell. And as you know, the CIA had a lot to do with that. And he said to me, you know, Elaine, he said, I can tell you that at some point in your life, you will be a victim of what he called, you know, the industrial military complex. And I sort of, that was all very heady for me at the time and quite crass that. But I think I do now, yes. And what I wanted to say is that, you know, I'm beginning to wonder if sometimes, you know, like you're saying about the vaccines, I know when I was doing the research on the vaccine for my show, I put sort of two and two together, and I understand that there was a woman who testified in front of Congress and or the Senate and said, oh, for God's sake, don't let this vaccine, I think it was the Salk vaccine or whatever, be marketed because it's full of monkey, you know, foreign monkey DNA, and
right.
You know, in the next 25 years, you are gonna, you know, you're gonna have plagues of cancer, like the planet's never seen, and of course, then that was absolutely right. We've seen an exponential rise in the rate of breast cancer, and what's the
Well,
male.
Environmental disease is rampant right
no,
now.
No, but I'm just, oh, prostate cancer, that
right.
was the one. And she actually predicted that that would happen. And in my darkest thoughts sometimes, I think to myself, you know, is this all planned? You know, like, do these corporations sit down, you know, and of course they're always working way ahead, you know, in their agendas and sort of say, well, look, guys, you know, if we can poison everybody with this, and then we have all the so-called treatments and cures for the disease that everyone's going to go down with 25 years from now, then, you know, we can do a double head whammy on this profit-wise. You know, it's a very sick thought, and of course it's just a speculation, but I have to tell you, in my darkest thoughts, I sometimes wonder if that's not what is going on. Now, let's hit the listeners with our whammy for today. I was amazed. I have to tell you, when I was speaking to Jamer for the first time, I about the whole Dow thing and silicon and the whole breast implant thing, I said, what is behind it? I said, I cannot understand, you know, this cover-up is so huge and so successful, and you know, it's gone on for so long that they've managed to whitewash this. It's just phenomenal. And I said, I'm beginning to wonder what's behind it. And of course, you know, then I did a bit more digging around, and I found out that, well, there were a lot of pension plans in the U.S. that would sort of go down the toilet if Dow was held liable for all of its for all of, you know, the litigation. And also I found out that Dow owned European banks, and, you know, hey, well, when was the last time you saw a Swiss bank go belly up, you know, and not too often. And then I found out, of course, that there were various insurance companies too that were also would be hit, huge insurance corporations. So I sort of thought, well, you know, that's what it is. It's the big bucks, and that's what it's all about. And then Jamie said to me, no. She said, let me tell you this. Do you realize that 99% of all the silicon actually is going into our food? And, of course, this is why, you know, the children's cases were dropped, was because they didn't want this to come out in the courtrooms about how these silicon compounds, you know, are, like you say, they affect the unborn child and children in a very bad way. And I was shattered. I couldn't believe it. I have to tell you, I was just stunned. And, of course, you know, now... When I was talking to you, and you managed to email me with some of the compounds and who manufactures them and the warnings that are on them, and then these compounds are used in the processing of our food, specifically anything. Mostly these compounds seem to be found in food that has a long shelf life. Is that right?
Exactly. And you know, if you don't mind, I'll just name a few. Just,
oh, please,
because
yes.
I was amazed. Canned fruits, vegetables, jams and jellies, potato chips, snack manufacturing, canned and cured seafoods, tofu, cane sugar refining, wines, meat and poultry rendering, fruit juice packaging, bean and vegetable processing. And then we get into things like dog and cat food processing, paper towel and cup release agents, food packaging, disposable food packaging. They use it in all kinds of any kind of processing inside of ice cream containers. The list literally just goes on and on and on. And, of course, some of the biggest processes is defoamers for frying, deep frying, or anything that would be frothy like canned pineapple juice. And so, you know, our nugget days of chicken nuggets all over. But one of the things that I had to, well, there were two things, kind of tongue-in-cheek again, and Elaine, you know my sense of humor, and I know yours, but it is humorous, but again, it is very, very sad.
Dark
when I
humor.
Looked at the food-grade silicone, the material safety data sheet, or the MSDS sheets that we go by, for OSHA and for looking at the EPA, which is so, you know, important of some of the side effects of the food-grade silicones. When they talk about GI irritation, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, headaches, dizziness, nasal and respiratory irritation. But then down at the very bottom of where you get down to the information about other precautions, you know, what jumped out at me was keep out of the reach of children.
Oh, wow.
And how can we keep it out of the reach of children when it's in our chicken nuggets, it's in, you know, everything from Jell-Os to different, you know, our juices that we're giving our children. And then Dow Corning makes one of the, of course, we're right back to follow the corporate greed. GE, or General Electric, who used to make breast implants, is one of the biggest leaders in silicone today throughout the world. And when I pulled their information on their silicones and their food processing, it shows this enormous vat of potato chips with these potatoes laying next to it. And when it talks about what benefits to the process it is, it says disperses readily in the system. And I think they mean in the system, in the pot you're frying in, but I know that, and you know, it disperses in the human body, in our system also. And so, you know, kosher foods, I know you and I discussed.
Oh, this totally blew me away. Of course. I mean, some of these things, you know, 100% kosher, recommended for Passover.
Right.
You know. Can
we just sort of remind our listeners, some of them might not know or understand what is meant by that term kosher?
I always assume that kosher means clean, right? And it's
yeah, it means like holy type of clean.
Exactly,
you're
for the Jewish faith.
That's
right.
And not eating blood and that kind of stuff violence of it and
the food codes. Yes, that's right. That's what I understand it means too.
Well, and the kosher food, because that is what they're going after. You know, I'm exactly under the same impression. When I think of kosher, even though I'm not Jewish, and because of my faith, I don't have to eat kosher foods, but I think of kosher foods, if I went to the store to pull off
as being good and wholesome,
that it was done in a certain way that was more clean, more sanitary,
was
more healthy even than what regular foods would be. And that is one thing that I think as, certainly as parents, we need to educate ourselves to the fact that just because something says flavored or natural, that is a wonderful sound bite that they love to fill in with us anymore. But with the natural, there are, what I have pulled up and learned, there are over 1,000 chemical food additives that the majority of them have been banned in already several countries. And what we're saying today, that if you want to put natural, or if you want to put wholesome, or if, you know, you want to, you don't have to tell what your French fries were fried in, or what hue or color, you know, we'll see a color number sometimes on our M&Ms to everything else. But basically, all that is chemicals. And the flavorings, banana shakes, everything else is simply a chemical compound which is made to taste that. So we're inundated with this, again, by the chemical cartel out there in this world that's making everything up to you know, taste like something, but all it is simply a chemical.
Well, yeah, and I mean, the thing is, back to the money part of things, if you're basically using an extremely cheap raw material, which of course sand is, right?
Right.
And you make, you know, a fortune sort of in all these areas, medical devices, food compounds.
Right.
It's the best form of alchemy, isn't it?
What we learned, even an artificial strawberry flavor, but let's just take strawberry, the favorite, at least flavor of the day or the month club, a typical artificial strawberry flavor contains 49 chemical compounds. 49. So, you know, everything from natural smoke flavor, it just goes on and on and on, that mm-hmm. we can take something that does not even supposed to be, you know, have, even for vegetarians, they're doing flavorings that contain fish, poultry, beef, or pork, and because it says natural, because it says vegetarian, or whatever a manufacturer can put on that, does not necessarily, of course, mean that's what we're getting. And then when we see, again, that silicone is added and being an adjuvant, I'm certainly not shocked as a medical professional or as an advocate or as an injured consumer that we have ended up with lupus, scleroderma, connective tissue disease, all of these thyroid problems, all of the different types of cancer, being my main specialty that I'm a cancer nurse, but that we're, as a society, we are where we are today because of what we're being spoon-fed, not only by the media, but by the manufacturers, who controls the media, by the way. So we're not shocked.
No, well, it's quite mind-boggling when you sit down and sort of total it all up that, you know, here you have, you know, millions of children who are getting the silicon compounds in utero, then through their mother's breast milk, then in all the foods that they eat. Then they have vaccines, you know, with other junk in them.
And needles to give the vaccines that are dipped in silicone. Let's not forget
that. Let's not forget that, too. Yes, of course.
And the IV bags that they're giving while you're in the hospital to deliver the babies with the phthalates and the plasticizers in there, you know, again, the PVCs. And, you know, now we're having warnings that not to heat IV solutions, not to give them to newborn infants. That took place just in the last 30 days on phthalates. And being hormonal disruptors, they're trying now. A lot of the researchers and even the FDA in the last 30 days has come out with some new standards on phthalates. So, you know, we have to be our own lawyer. We have to be our own doctor. We have to be everything. But you best be your own advocate today, because if not, certainly if you don't ask questions, and not only ask questions, be that professional skeptic and ask for package inserts, ask for material safety data sheets. A good one is even a dentist. Most of your fillings are anywhere about 70% silica, and which is sand, which is also a derivative, of course, a different derivative, but that silica can also stimulate. Silicosis of the lungs is from sandblasting and that type of thing. Now we're seeing that doctors doing root canals, they use silicone oil inside of a root canal. Then we wonder, you know, Elaine, why we lose our teeth after we've had our breast implants and our gums and all of our problems. You know, it is a constant barrage of chemical toxin and injury to the human body, never ending.
Yeah, well,
I do call it the never-ending story, in fact.
Yeah, well, that's what I would say. I've had chemotherapy for 10 years.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So
yeah.
Hopefully with your platinum injection that you have been, it's an ongoing joke in our house. I'm the true concept of the platinum blonde from platinum being in my breast implants. But, yeah, you know, we have to. We cannot sit by and idly sit by as consumers. And I know I had a discussion with my parents saying, well, you know, you need to ask the doctor, why is he giving you this medication? Ask for to see the PDR and what it's made out of. And my mother says, well, I don't want to offend the doctor. And I said, Mother, it is your body. It is your right to ask these questions. And if they cannot provide the data, then you do not need to go to these so-called medical professionals.
Well, going back to the silicon compounds in the food, now what sort of problems do we see in children who you know, eat a lot of junk food? What I mean, we see what? Hyperactivity, attention deficit syndrome.
Absolutely.
Do you think that's linked?
Absolutely. That is some of the big things that very much organizations here in the United States, and I believe several even outside the United States that are looking at one of the attention deficit disorder, ADD and ADHD, learning disabilities with those. Then we're seeing, again, very much allergies. You know, and interesting enough to kind of prove their point with these organizations that work on attention deficit disorders. And they, one of the things that they recommend, of course, is that you regulate the child's diet with ADHD and ADD itself. And when they start regulating these diets, they're bringing these children back to not having as many attention deficit problems. They're also seeing that with autistic children, Elaine. They're working on correcting and helping with the diet. And even though the main injury may be the vaccine, who is to say that we're not adding insult to injury by adding, again, this barrage of these toxins and these chemicals on top of these kiddos that have been damaged by the vaccines? It all makes sense to us, common good sense, in fact.
Yeah, so really we're going to, if this continues, like you say, and doesn't get arrested by the FDA and Health Canada and all the other regulators in the world, we're going to have this incredible bulge of middle-aged people going down with all these autoimmune disorders.
Well, absolutely, because their immune systems with the children, of course, are being changed and totally and forever changed, even in utero, like you said, by the mother being, you know, subjected to injections and breast implants and different things, or even in our drinking water. One of the other interesting things that one of the hyperactive children support groups is looking at is even studies, of course, about teenagers and the kids that are killing each other in schools. You know, we're wondering on diet, why are we seeing these children that literally are having these psychological problems and shooting their teachers and shooting many of them in their classes? Of why? And they're looking into eliminating foods with synthetic coloring is one of the things that they're looking at in these new studies to see in school lunches about getting rid of high sugar content because the sugars are refined with the silicones again. So, you know, we're in the baby steps of learning processes. We can look at already the environmentally endangered, and which is us. We are your environmentally endangered, not so much the animals, but ourselves, on where and what we're following. But to leave the legacy to our children is absolutely, besides being a shame, it is absolutely, to me, a sin and an insult that what the manufacturers are doing.
Yeah, a black mark on humanity. Now, I wanted to, just before the end of the show, we haven't got a lot of time left, but I just wanted to touch on the phthalates. I have had an education, albeit a short one, but I intend to go into it further from your web pages on phthalates. Now, tell our listeners, what are phthalates?
Absolutely. Phthalates are...
I said it right, did I?
You did say it
okay,
right.
Okay, pronounce
phthalates, and phthalates are simply a family of industrial chemicals that are used as a plastic softener or solvents, specifically in many different consumer products. And they can be absorbed through the skin, they can be inhaled as fumes, they can be ingested and with contaminated or food. The children that their PVCs is polyvinyl chloride is what they are, even in used in medical devices. And for anyone that's saying, I wonder, even if they were used in breast implants, the answer was yes, that phthalates are in and were in some of the older breast implants. And what they're even doing, the Center of Devices, they're looking at 45 times or 45 different phthalates and combinations that are used on the daily intake level of young women. And that's what happens, you know, the phthalates that are being used in perfumes and fingernail polishes and all of this thing, you see your younger age groups, your very young women, the very precious woman that is going to have children later on. Those are the ones that we're so concerned about. And, of course, they're looking at animal studies on phthalates that can damage the liver, the kidneys, the lungs, but especially the reproductive system. And again, where that's usually showed up is in the developing testes of male offspring. And very, very much concerned of where we're seeing and the list of where phthalates can be. We have here at the University of Missouri, here in Columbia, Missouri, where I reside and where our organization is, Dr. Frederick Von Saal is a phthalates expert. And with it being a hormonal disruptor, he is very much looking in cosmetic toys. It's in flooring, adhesives, wallpaper, furniture, raincoat, shower curtain, list. It just goes on and on and on, and over 5,000 beauty and personal care products for women.
Yeah, I have to say, talking about dark humor, notice that Christian Dior's Poison perfume has phthalates.
Yes.
Good name that they decided to name it
Poison.
Totally appropriate.
Totally appropriate.
Truth in advertising.
Yes, truth in advertising, Kathy.
Absolutely. But, you know, with it being, especially being polyvinyl chloride, I mean, you know, very much, again, when you say to someone, I know a lot of the breast implant attorneys that we have networked with over the years and discussed about women's cases, to say, oh, well, you know, these breast implant women, they ask for it. You know, they ask for these breast implants to be put in their body. And I love to look at these lawyers and say, and you think you're free from being chemically injured? I mean, every injection you have ever received, your pacifiers that you give to your newborn babies right here today, and the toys that you bought your little boy to suck on this afternoon and to play with, and the
that
nail
new
polish.
Car smell.
Right.
The smell of a new car.
Yeah, the new car smell. That's a good one, too.
It's there.
But,
know
you know,
it's
hairsprays,
there.
Deodorants, there are your phthalates. And so that is the latest, you know, besides the mercury poisoning that Toxic Discovery Network, that we'll be doing conferences in 2003, you know, around the United States, and hopefully, Lane, we're looking to come up your way and to even do something maybe next year.
Yeah, well, I just would like to thank you so much for being with us today, and I'm sure my listeners will agree with me that you've enlightened us all here in Victoria. I mean, I haven't read in any newspapers or anything about phthalates, so obviously, you know, this is news to a lot of our listeners today, and I'm sure when they trot down to the takeaway and get their glistening chicken nuggets, they're going
that's
to
right.
view them in a slightly different
that's right.
light.
And if the only thing that, again, I would like to remind everyone, and not putting in a plug, of course, with us being a not-for-profit, and I'm a professional volunteer for our organization, so I don't make a penny off of it, but they can go to our website, which is Toxic.
Oh, yes. Tell us all. Now, that's another thing. I want to give the listeners all the information they need.
I will.
So, yes, I'll let you do that now.
ToxicDiscovery.com is our website, and our new website will be up by September 1, which we will carry things, everything from, again, the thimerosal to the phthalates to FinFin medical device failures. But we do have a toll-free number, and it is listed on our website, but it's 1-800-462-9106. And we're open 5 days a week, Monday through Friday from 9 to 5. You'll get usually a medical professional that's manning our phones or a volunteer. We all are injured consumers that volunteer our time. Most are all medical professionals, if not doctors, registered nurses. And our organization simply is to listen to the consumer to find out what the injury and to either refer them to a reputable doctor or if a class action, we do have a preference list of attorneys that we're very cautious about who we refer to. We network with the plaintiff liaison's office to make sure they're reputable lawyers, to be able to handle a case concerning an injured consumer. But if nothing else, we can refer them to the FDA or send them information that we carry in our files on studies. And our website does change often and sometimes almost daily, depending on what information is out there. We can also refer them to a support group or a private email list, and our information is confidential. We never get our database information to anyone.
So you're a real clearinghouse then for all those poisoned people.
We are a real clearinghouse, and again, if anyone would want to, you know, information about that, to either check our website or to find out if they'd like a conference held in their area, or, you know, just whatever it is, they can email us by going to our website or leave a message on our answering machine. Or you really get to talk to a real live body when you call our organization. You don't just get someone pressing numbers saying they'll get back to you with a packet of information.
And I'm sure, Kathy, you welcome all donations, don't you?
We certainly do. We're working on our not-for-profit. We have our state level, and we're working on our federal right now to get grant money, especially for Toxic 2 Kids. We've been doing several fundraisers as we're doing our conferences. Pampered Chef is one that has been, for buying so much Pampered Chef, they're giving back to our organization. We're hoping to do more and more of that as injured consumers are awarded for class action injuries, to be able to give, hopefully, that, even like the American Cancer Society, you know, to give a legacy. We've had so many women, Elaine, I hate to say, that have died that we believe from a direct correlation of a failed medical device, and a lot of those families are wanting to, you know, start different kind of scholarships and things in their wife or their family member's name to be able to find an answer for this and to bring the truth forward to the public.
Well, in closing, I lifted another quote from your site, and I'm just going to share it with the listeners now. Today, the trans-global corporations have created a David and Goliath situation, spending millions on biased studies and hiding in bankruptcy, protecting the corporation, not the consumer, who used their hard-working dollars to purchase the product in the first place. Brilliant. Well said. Now, Kathy, we're going to have you back on the show again, but I want to thank you very sincerely for sharing all your hard-earned knowledge with our listeners in Victoria.
You're most welcome, Elaine. We're delighted to do it, and we can just leave just with the last suggestion is don't ever assume anything. Read your package inserts. Read your labels on all of your products.
But I like your victim thing, too. What's that victim slogan that you have? That's very good. What is it? About something about victims. Why?
Well, we say empower with knowledge, and truly an informed, to be an informed individual, you have to have informed consent. It requires an informed individual.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks a lot, Kathy.
Thank you, Elaine.